You're right.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Parashat Vayeshev. From our human perspective, we are mere mortals. Read through Parashat Vayeshev, and it most probably can be described as the most tragic parasha in Torah. What we see in Parashat Vayeshev is a great family crumbling, disintegrating, in an absolutely unimaginable and tragic way. Tragic way. Family falls apart. And this is a sefer that begins with Vayeshev Yaakov. Yaakov, as Rashi says, Yaakov wanted to set it down already. Genug. There is so much trial and tribulation and travail in life. He had to flee from Esau, he had to flee from Laban. He had a pretty difficult life. And here it is, his family begins to fall apart before his very eyes. He doesn't really know everything that's happening, but whatever he does know is enough to send him into deep mourning from which he simply is not consoled. The relationship between the brothers on the one hand and Yosef on the other, it begins with Yosef in his dreams. The brothers first, they are envious of him, and then it says that ugly word, they hated him. God, the word hate, when used from Jew to fellow Jew, is something that causes me a tremendous amount of pain. One can imagine how much pain it causes to Yaakov. The brothers hate Yosef. Yaakov sends Yosef at some later point, he sends him to find out how his brothers are doing with the sheep, grazing their sheep in Shechem. And then we have that little story that we'll have a few words to say about. He comes to Shechem, he doesn't find his brothers, a mysterious man meets him in the field. What are you looking for? Can I help you? Yes, and the great, great words that resonate across the centuries. Et achai anochi v'vakesh, I seek my brothers. All right, then he finally finds his brothers, and then we know the tragedy that ensues. They sell a brother off into slavery, they wanted to kill him. It's horrendous. And then there's a chapter 38, and we didn't spend our time in chapter 38. 38 seems to be like some kind of an insert. In the middle of the story of the sale of Yosef, Yosef is on his way down to Egypt. There is a pause, an interruption. The story of Yehuda. Right, what a story that is. Yehuda, two of his sons die, then his wife dies, and then he meets this woman on the road, and he lives with her, and it's really his daughter-in-law, Tamar. I mean, this truth is far stranger than fiction. And then we're going to see the psukim. A few months later, he's told that his daughter-in-law is pregnant in an illicit and illegal way. And she, meanwhile, has taken from him pledges, he promises that he's going to give her a goat. And she took his signet ring, his cloak, his staff, and then most certainly two of the greatest psukim in Torah. But let's start looking a little bit. Number one, about the two-thirds down the page, it's underlined. Vayikim Yishlosh Chavashim, it was our 3 months later, after Yehuda had lived with this woman whom he assumed was a woman of ill repute. 3 months later, by Yugav, Yehuda was told, Lame was saying, Zonto Tomor Karotecho, your daughter-in-law, Tomor, has lived with somebody illicitly. She is threatened from that illicit act. Vayomer Yehuda, Yehuda said, Hatziua, take her out, v'tisareg, and she should be burned at the stake. What a psak halacha. And then comes, it's not to be believed. V'hisholcha el chomi olemor. Maybe her first reaction would have been, Yehuda, you are condemning me to be burned at the stake? You won! No. Tamar, in the most delicate way possible, her life hangs in the balance. Delicate. Able. He shocha el chomiyah, she sent to her father-in-law saying, L'ish asher ol ela lo anochi hora, to the man whom these belong, the signet ring, the staff, the cloak, from him I am pregnant. Vatomer, and she said, Hakerna, identify, L'mi hachotemet baktilim b'amateh ela. To whom does this signet ring, this cloak, and this staff belong? Now that word hakerno is extremely important, that it's going to become more and more important, because I'm going to take you up to the top of the page. The top of the page, the end, toward the end of chapter 37. It says, when I'm reading from the very top, by Yichud Ksanes Yosef, Yosef, they took Yosef's cloak, by Yishchatu Seir Izin, and they slaughtered a goat, by Yidlur Hakutanet Vazam, and they put his cloak into the blood, by Yisharchu Ketonet Hapasim, by Yavivu Aliyam, they sent the Ketonet Pasim to somebody, the cloak of many colors, by Yavivu Aliyam, and they brought it to their father, by Yomar, and they said, Zot Matsonu, this is what we have found. Haker no. Identify it. Precisely the same words that Tamar says to Yehuda. Haker no. Please identify it. And of course, our rabbis say, this is the punishment. Precisely, exactly what the brothers did, this is what's happening to Yehuda now. Hakerno, identify. Interesting also, they slaughtered a goat. A goat is what Yehuda had promised to Tamar. It's all very, very fascinating. Hakerno, Tanet Bimchayim Lo, is this the cloak of your son or not? By Yakira, he identified it by Yomer. Ketonet b'ni, it's the cloak of my son, Chayor Roa Aholotu, he has been consumed by a wild animal, Tarof Taraf Yosef. Yaakov is the one who makes this decision. He's been torn apart by Nikar Yaakov, so we'll tell Yaakov tears his garments, by Yosef Sakra Moslem, and he put sackcloth on his loins, by his avail of the Rav Yom Gavin, and he mourns for his son for a long time.
Yaakov called all the sons and all his daughters arise to console him, and he refused to be consoled. Back to what we were reading before. We're going to come now, most probably, to the two. When I say the two most powerful and amazing words in Torah, this is not just another one of Gold's amazing, gewaltige, great, outstanding sukkim. By Yoni Yehuda, Yehuda said, "Tzadika mimeni." She is right. It is from me. It is from me that she has become pregnant. The power of that instant admission. Yehuda finds himself in a most uncomfortable and difficult position. He's the one who passed judgment on her. And now he himself, the courage, the strength, the determination of Yehuda, which is expressed in these two words, means he is somebody who takes responsibility. He takes responsibility. And that's going to be the essence of the shir, and you'll find out soon why. She's going to give birth a few months later. She's going to have twins, Peretz and Zarah. These are the children of Yehuda. Peretz ultimately is going to be the great Zeta of Dorano, which means that he's also going to be the Zeta of Mashiach, salvation for the world. So here it is, it's a tragic parasha. Right after this parasha, we'll see, Yosef is brought down to Egypt. Potiphar's wife is the one who attempts to seduce him. He ends up in prison. We're talking, and the family is just disintegrating, falling apart. It's a tragic parasha. But you know what? Our rabbis had a completely different perspective on this parasha. It's all tragic. Everything is falling apart. The family that is supposed to be the very underpinning of a great and eternal people is no more, doesn't exist. The family is at this point in time destroyed. And I'll take you to number 5 for a minute. On the next page, number 5. This is a Rashi on the first pasuk in chapter 38. I know, I'm moving you around. You know, you'll get it. Chapter 38, Vayehi begins with the words at that time, Vayede Yehuda Me'edeho. Yehuda went down from his brothers. And Rashi says, that's number 5, Vayehi Ba'etahi, it was at that time, Lama Nisnacha Parsha Zulakam. This Rashi is extremely significant. Because about 150 years ago, and most probably even until today, the biblical scholars with a very small s have said that this parasha just doesn't belong here. It's an interruption. It has no place over here. So obviously, they assumed that this was from a different source, and some unknown editor stitched it in over here. In other words, 150 years ago, there was a movement called the movement of biblical criticism. Higher biblical criticism, lower biblical criticism, nonsense that the world was, you can still go to even university and get all sorts of courses in biblical criticism. And one of their big points is this parasha just doesn't belong here. We're talking about the end of chapter 37 said that Yosef was brought down to Egypt. 39 begins the
by repeating that Yosef was brought down to Egypt. Who needed this parsha a little? It happened once someplace else. Some unknown editor put it in over there because Torah was not the, by God, no. So Rashi asks the question that has vexed biblical critics. Why is this parsha of Yehuda here? It's an interruption. We're in the middle of the story of Yosef. We have to hold our breath through a whole chapter 38 to find out what happened. What happened? What's going on with Yosef? So why is this passage juxtaposed at this point? The Hivsik parasha Tosha Yosef, and it interrupted the parasha of Yosef. L'marmeid, shehoritu echov migetu lasso. Vayyeged Yehuda mi'et echov, Rashi is learning, doesn't mean simply that he left his brothers and went down. Vayyeged Yehuda mi'et echov means his brothers brought him down. He had been the leader of the family. It seems he had the personality of leadership. But no, they brought him down. And that Judah's brothers took him down from his greatness, from his position of leadership among them. When they saw the distress of their father, they said, "Ato amarto l'machrau. You said that we should sell him. Ilu amarto l'hashivo. Would you have said that we should return him to his father? Are you inshallah? We would listen to you." See what's happening over here? We are going to take this much, much further in Yitz Hashem next week. But what's happening over here is the blame game. They're placing the blame for the full profound tragedy on Yehuda. If you would have told us, bring him back home, we would have done it. What do you mean? They're not intelligent individuals? They don't have free will? They don't have choice? They don't know what the right thing to do is? It's ugly shifting of blame. And that shifting of blame is capable of destroying an entire family. By the way, destroying an entire people. Shifting blame is afraid to say it, you know. Just what Klal Yisrael needed right now. New elections, you'll be hearing it. I won't blame be shifted all over again. Anything that's wrong in the economy, it's not Pitt's fault. Most probably is, all right. Anything that's wrong here or wrong there. And of course, there will be those who consider themselves the center to left, they're going to blame. Netanyahu is the worst thing that ever happened to Klal Yisrael. They will blame everything on him. Blame everything on him. I happen to be a Netanyahu loyalist, but that has nothing to do with the Shia. I just have to say it, that's all. But anyway, it's not only that I had to say it. I don't know if you notice, and I feel like I'm a real Yerushalmi. When I open up the Jerusalem Post yesterday, four people I know had letters to the editor. Yesterday was Toby Willett, Jenny Weil, Renny Hirsch from Netanya, and Nancy Chernosky, Phil's sister-in-law from Harlow. Four letters to the editor. And that's how, calling last week, I think it was Wednesday, the terror of all Iron Nosenchak had a letter to the editor. That he's back. He's back, and the Jerusalem Post is shaking with, when Iron's letters come. By the way, the four letters that I'm talking about were really very, very good letters. I called Jenny Wilde and I told her she wrote a good letter. And I left a message for Nancy Chernowski. The others I couldn't get. All right. They're blaming Yehuda. They're not ready to take responsibility. That's at the beginning of chapter 38. You know, when you compare that with the two awesome words that are uttered by Yehuda, Son call me many. You know what he's doing? He is unequivocally taking responsibility. I am responsible. It's me. Now you'll understand a message. Number two. It's at the end of the second line of number two, it's a medrash. What a medrash! What an insight to this parsha. And it came to pass at that time. That was the beginning of chapter 38. At that time, Yehuda went down, or was brought down by his brothers. And there comes the whole sordid story, seemingly, of Yehuda and Tamar. Rav Shmuel bar Nachman, Patar Rav Shmuel bar Nachman began to explain this parsha. With a pasuk in Yirmiyahu. Ki anochi yodati et hamachshavot. God says, I know what everybody is thinking. Shvotim hayu asukim b'nechidato shel Yosef. This is a perspective of our rabbis in the Medrash on this parsha Vayeshev. The tribes were involved with the sale of Yosef. Yosef haya asuk b'sako b'tanito. Yosef was in the process of doing tshuva for all the trouble that he started. And he wore sackcloth and was fasting. Reuven had asuk the sackcloth of the tov. Reuven was involved doing tshuva for a number of things that he had done and was sitting with sackcloth and fasting. The Yaakov had asuk the sackcloth of the tov. Yaakov is in mourning and he has wearing sackcloth and he's fasting. The Yehuda had asuk likach elisha. And Yehuda is involved in trying to find a wife for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But the Holy One, blessed be He, this is unbelievable. HaKadosh Baruch Hu haya osek bodei oro shel melech HaMashiach. This dark, dismal parsha, where everything that can go wrong is going wrong, from God's perspective, you know what's happening? He's in the process of laying the groundwork for the light of Mashiach. What a beautiful Kodesh Baruch Hu haya osek borei oro shel melech HaMashiach. You know what that means? You read through the parsha and you see all sorts of events happening, people doing things. People going, people coming, and you think that it's all, you know, very normal. People are doing what they want to do. But we understand history and Torah on a second, even more significant level, beneath the surface of the parsha, or really bubbling up to the surface of the parsha, there's somebody who's moving the pawns around from one place to the next. There's somebody with a divine plan. That God is the one who's moving things, because He has the ultimate plan. And that ultimate plan calls for Yaakov and his family to go down to Egypt. And the path is being paved for them by Yosef. A David and a Moshiach have to be created. That's Yehuda. All of these are movements on the board, the chessboard. So it's not only what we see before our very eyes. There's an underpinning to everything. Strings. People are being moved. And the classic example in this parsha that really illuminates the entire parsha, Yaakov sends Yosef to find out how his brothers are doing. They're grazing the sheep in Shechem. Understand? He arrives in Shechem.
he looks here and he looks that he can't find his brothers. I can imagine what's going on up in heaven. Yosef has to meet up with his brothers. The tragedy of the sale of Yosef has to take place. He has to go down to Mitzrayim. Everything has to happen. And all of a sudden, a puncher. Do I have to describe what a puncher is? A flat tire. Something went wrong. It's not working. If Yosef doesn't find his brothers, then the whole story ends prematurely and is a borderline failure, and Jewish world history simply comes to some kind of an ignominious end in a field outside Shechem. In heaven, the Malachim are sweating. They're nervous. They're popping vagins. No. A man appears in the field. And the man who appears in the field approaches Yosef and asks him, you need help. You're looking for something. Can I help you? And we're talking about somebody who knows what he's talking about. He's not going to tell Yosef, Telef Yashav Yashav Vishan Tishav. Go Yashav, and then you'll ask, you know, the classic way of sending somebody off in all sorts of wrong directions. No. Let's see, number two, the Ramban elucidates it. There are two Rambans over here. Let's take a look at the second one. A man found him, and behold, he's wandering in the field. He was lost on the road and didn't know where to go. And he went into a field. He's seeking his brother someplace in the field where they would be grazing the sheep. The Yara HaKosuvah said, and the prophet tells us this, Lahagid, two beautiful things the Ramban is going to say. This is a classic Ramban. The Yara HaKosuvah said, the prophet tells us the whole story of his man, Lahagid, to tell you, Kisipo Drabod Bo Elov Shoyo Royal Azalov. There were many reasons that Yosef had that he could have decided to turn around, go straight home, and not carry out the mission that his father had placed upon him. I came, I looked, they're not here, who knows where they are, how am I going to find them? But then he keeps looking. Yosef is going to suffer all of this wandering only because he wants to fulfill what his father asked him. Ulohdienu Od. This is the great one-liner of the Ramban. To tell us also, Ki Hakizeiro Emet Vachalitzut Sheker. This is an unbelievable line. One of the great classic lines in the Ramban. Hakizeiro Emet, God's decree is true. It will happen. Vachalitzut and all of man's efforts to undo that which God plans are all false. Nothing will come of it. Anybody who thinks that they're going to be able to give away Eretz Yisrael to people who are not Jewish is such nonsense. It will never be. God promises dozens of times in Torah that it's ours. They will never get it. And if they get it, they're going to mess it up. There is no such thing. The Shomu Allah Yevetim, it says in Parashat Chukotai, that your enemies are going to be desolate upon the land. That's exactly what's going to happen. I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever. Every time I hear somebody, you know, talking about the two-state solution, my, what fools these mere mortals are. Hagizeho Enes, the decree of God is truth, the Hachavitzut Sheker, and all of men's efforts are false. Because you know what happened here in the field? God brought Moreh Derech, a guide, Shalom Idato, Now, this can be, according to the Rambam, this fellow may even be a human being. And that person himself doesn't even know what a crucial and pivotal person he is in the entire drama of world history. He just happens to be on the spot, and he sees somebody's lost, and he just happens to know where the brothers are. He doesn't even know that he's the God's messenger. Oh, God. God has messages all over. Friends, does he have messages all over? Ah. Well, the Zenit Kavnun, Rabbotinu, the Rabban says, that's what our rabbis had in mind. But Omram, when they said, Ki ho'ishim ha'elahim alam, that these people are angels. They don't have to be terrestrial beings. A Malach is a messenger. God sends all sorts of messages. You never know. You never know. It could be the weather. It could be a flat tire. Because for a flat tire, you don't get to where you wanted to go. And there's a pigua over there. The flat tire was God's messenger. That's the only thing that happened all the time. All the time. Alright? Shalom al chinam haya kol ha-sipur hazeh. This whole story of Yosef with the man in the field is not for naught. I mean, one could very well ask, he got to his brothers? That's the most important thing. He left home and he got to his brothers. So I have to know that when he passed Shiloh, he made a wrong turn. Understand? He made a wrong turn and he had to go back. And maybe he had to fill up with gas when he came around that lake. Do I have to know all the details of his journey? Why does the Torah write it, the Rambam says? Because these details of the journey are extremely significant. This is God acting in history. He has a plan. He wants to create the life of Moshiach. And everything is going to happen exactly as he planned it. No one is going to frustrate God's plan. No. Sodekah, Mimeni. Those are the two great words. Yehuda takes responsibility. The two words Tzadka Mimeni also happen to be the title of a book that was recently published by Geffen Publishing. Here's the book. Tzadka Mimeni. It was written by a good friend of mine, Rabbi Stephen Pruszynski, who's gotten some nice, he's been appearing in the Jerusalem Post, don't they? Now, I wasn't really sure whether I should bother to read the book, but then I opened up, and the first page, there is a haskama, an approbation from a fellow who's the founding rabbi of Kehillat Zichron Yosef in Harnov, Dean of the Avraham Silva Jerusalem College for Adults at the OU Israel Center, Rabbi Dr. Shalom Gold. I took a look at this. If he says it's a good book, it's got to be a good book. From my letter, you'll get the point of the entire, of this entire Sefer. And it's fascinating. It's good. Rabbi Pruszynski Sefer, and in parentheses, Gold says, I can't call it a book, is of vital importance. People have always tried to divest themselves of blame and cast it on others. In recent years, we have been witnessing an unprecedented flight from responsibility and an abandonment of accountability. I can't believe that I wrote such a good sentence. For some people, transferring decision-making to others is seen as a virtue to be pursued. It is not perceived as weakness, but rather strength. It does in fact mean relinquishing the essence of one's humanity. If I leave vital decisions in my life to somebody else, a rebbe, a hoshiva, a therapist, then I am abdicating Did I use that word? Let's see. It does in fact mean relinquishing the essence of one's humanity, which calls upon us to exercise the divine gift of free will in an intelligent and responsible way. That's all of life. All of life is God gave us free will. We have to use that free will. So then, I describe something that is so timely now. This was written a while ago. Once, when I was riding through Har Nof with some fine gentleman, I innocently asked him, since it was election time. It's election time again. It's always election time. And the interludes between one election to the other is just waiting for the next election. All right? It was election time. So I asked this fellow who was sitting in my car, I asked him for whom he was planning to vote. He responded that he didn't know yet because he hadn't asked his Rav. Right? Now, with all the emotional strength I could muster, I continued driving responsibly and calmly and said to him, when I told him of the following, when Sanhedrin had to vote on a case of capital punishment, the halacha is clear. 70 members of the Sanhedrin, or 23 of a small Sanhedrin, the voting begins with the youngest. It doesn't begin with the head of the Sanhedrin. You know why it doesn't begin with the head of the Sanhedrin? Because he certainly will influence all those who come afterwards, after him. Torah wanted that in something that may very, that involves life and death, Torah wants to know, what do you say? And therefore they start with the youngest member of the Sanhedrin. Each person has to say what he thought out. I cannot divest myself of responsibility and just say, what me, worry, bother, think? My Rav will tell me, and that's what I'm going to do. It's anti-Torah. Torah wants the honest opinion of each member, devoid of the inevitable powerful influence of the senior members. Voting in Israeli elections is always an act that involves questions of life and death. We need your own opinion, not someone else's. I doubt that my words were understood or appreciated. Not a chance of the word. They didn't get it. I mean, I get it time and time again from people. I didn't know where to sell my house, I asked my Rav. I didn't know where to go on vacation, I asked my Rav. Here I read an article, a few weeks ago I read an article about a woman was describing that she has three different Ravs. She has a Rav for educational matters, she has a Rav for financial matters, and she has a Rav for spiritual matters. God. God. That's simply abdicating responsibility. That's not what Torah wants. It's anti-Torah. Boy, some people will hear this year. Why? The classic work of Jewish ethical literature, the Mesillat Yesharim, opens with that famous first line, the foundation of saintliness and the root of perfection in the service of God lies in a man's coming to see clearly and to recognize as a truth the nature of his duty in the world and the end toward which he should direct his vision and his aspiration in all of his labors, all the days of his life. The pivotal word is duty, which means responsibility. Rabbi Kuzansky's Sefer is dedicated to clarifying the profound significance of that term, responsibility. This is only volume one, and it's on Sefer Bereishit and Shemot, where he points out, parsha after parsha, the importance of taking responsibility. It's so fundamental, because all of Yahrzeit is based on the idea that we have free will, and we have to exercise that free will. If I leave these decisions up to anybody else,
then I'm not exercising my free will. Asadol said, yeah, I'm exercising my free will, because I had a choice of five Ravs, and I took Rav C instead of Rav A and B. Okay? Anyway, the reader who studies his faithful and richly rewarded, his insights are creative, incisive, and wise. Rabbi Brzezinski opens up a vast Torah panorama that is so desperately needed. I commend him. Okay, that's a very nice approbation. I thought he wouldn't even publish it, but it seems that there's one person who's not ashamed of having my name in his book. Yeah, Ira, what do you want?
Somebody who might have more knowledge than you, more
experience. We don't come here to the middle and stand up over here.
I'll speak louder.
You have to say, you want, yes?
Is it considered to be abdicating one's responsibility
if,
by asking somebody who might have greater knowledge and understanding than you what their opinion is?
No.
What their advice is?
No.
I agree.
I can ask advice. This fellow was not asking advice. His intention was not to study anything about the elections. Just tell me what to do. Advice? We need advice. But when push comes to shove, the decision has to be something that I thought it out and arrived at the decision. Okay? That you're okay now? Down, boy. Well, you know, if it's me, who are you going to ask?
Then I should follow blindly.
Yeah, that's right. So here, on the very last page, I give you part of what he says. They have, we'll start with six. Six is the underlined, Sardaka, Mimeni, that's this expressive. And Yehuda recognized the pledges and said, she is more righteous than I, and as I did not give her to Shelah, my son. He was supposed to have given her, Tamar had married Er, the oldest son of Yehuda, who died. Then she married Onan, and he died. And the third one was Shelah. She was supposed to be given to Shelah. But Yehuda was afraid that if two already died being married to her, who knows what will happen with the third. So he never kept his promise. But the delusion, Malchus has to come out of Yehuda and Tamar. It will happen. God will arrange for it to happen. Now, this decisive event in Jewish history gave this work its name. Rabbi Brzezinski's sefer is called Sadka Mimeni, as it is one of the most illustrious and obvious examples of personal responsibility in the Torah. Up on to page 115. No other had such far-reaching circumstances. And you know what he's going to quote now? He's going to quote now the Medrash that we learned. After the sale of Yosef, the brothers resorted to recrimination and bitterness. Yosef, Reuven, and Yaakov all grieved and fasted. Yehuda went to find a wife, and God set about creating the light of the Mashiach. So we took that Medrash in one sense, the sense that beneath the surface of events, there's somebody moving heaven and earth in order that his, with a capital H, his plan should be realized. From this sordid episode, mitigated only that it took place before the giving of the Torah Sinai, the royal house of Israel that endures for all eternity came into existence. With some coming many, you know what's happening over here? The eternity of the Jewish people is established. Those two words bring us to the point of
assuming responsibility, and ultimately, in a sense, responsibility for the whole world. And all because of one choice that Yehuda made. An act of assuming responsibility. Tamar, twice Yehuda's daughter-in-law, but now alienated from him, schemed to remain part of his household by dressing as a harlot and enticing him at a highway junction. The plan worked, and she conceived, brought to trial and sentenced to death for her apparently scandalous conduct. She was still nominally waiting to be assigned in marriage to Yehuda's third son, but was now pregnant with another man's child, Yehuda. She delicately brought out the pledges that she had taken from the paramour in lieu of payment. As she was taken out, she sent word to her father-in-law saying, "I am pregnant with the child of the man to whom these items belong." And she said, "Please identify to whom belongs this signet seal set." Notice how coy and discreet was Tamar, never identifying Yehuda by name. Never said that. There's an awesome Gemara that he's going to bring now. What a powerful statement. There is no other religion on the face of this earth that has any kind of statement that comes to close, it comes anywhere close to this. And they're leaving her fate. Notice how coy and discreet was Tamar, never identifying Yehuda by name, and thereby leaving her fate to his moral judgment and sense of responsibility. This is the Gemara. It is better for a person to be thrown into a fiery furnace than to embarrass another individual in public. No religion could ever express it in film. What are you talking about? I'm innocent! Rather die than insult somebody publicly. That's a very, very powerful ethical and moral principle. Wow. The Talmud derived from Tamar's conduct here, and Yehuda could have remained silent, avoided the public humiliation, and permitted Tamar to be executed. No one would have been the wiser, and Tamar, widow of two of his sons, would have been gone forever. No more problems with Tamar. At this perilous moment, Yehuda stepped up and assumed responsibility for his actions. Sod Kamimani, there are two ways to learn the word Sod Kamimani. Rashi explains the phrase to mean, "She is right, it is from me." That's really the simple meaning. Sod Kam, she is right. Mimani, that child is from me. In other words, the items in question belong to me. Are Yehuda and the father or child? The Ramban and the Rashbam explain the phrase in a different way. Sod Kamimani, she is more right than me. There are two ways to read these two awesome words. Sodka, she is right. I admit, Mimani, she is pregnant for me. Or Ramban and Rashbam, she is far more righteous than I am. She is more righteous than I am. Her deeds are more honorable. She is virtuous, and I am a sinner, for I failed to give her in marriage to my son, Shiloh. Here comes the fundamental principle of assuming responsibility. When the brothers send Yosef's garment soaked in blood, you know what that is? They're not taking responsibility. I'm afraid I'm going to quote somebody that I really don't like at all. Tzipi Livni said last week, and oh, forgive me.
I wash my mouth now.
Tzipi Livni said last week, when she was fired, Netanyahu couldn't have fired me face to face. The truth is, I can understand him. Who wanted to look at her? So said somebody else. didn't justify Netanyahu. But here, the brothers didn't have the courage to bring the coat. They're going to deceive their father, but no. Even in the deception, they're not ready to take responsibility. They send it to somebody else. Let him reach his own conclusions. And that's going to be the whole issue that is going to vex a family for 22 years. And I said we will deal with that issue in greater depth next week. But what I also gained, I personally gained a great deal by this, from this year. What I gained by it is the following. Something that I remember talking about it some years ago this year here. Everybody started up with me. Here it is. Take a look. Number four. Go back. Second page. Number four. This is from next week's standard. Practice the case. Vayar Yosef et Echov. The brothers have come down to Egypt. There's a famine in the land. They need food. Their father tells them, I heard that there's food in Egypt. Go down and purchase food for us. And when they come, they are brought to Chofnat Paneach. Vayar Yosef et Echov Vayakidein. And Yosef saw his brothers Vayakidein, and he recognized them. And he acted like a stranger toward them. And he spoke with them harshly. And he said to them, where have you come from? They said, we just came from Canaan to buy food. They recognized Yosef. And Yosef recognized them. The Hanglo Hikidu, and they didn't recognize him. I remember giving a shiur some years ago, and we may even touch upon this again next week. Why didn't they recognize him? Alright? Of course, immediately there's something, well, listen, Rashi says that when he left, he didn't have a beard, and now he has a beard, so they didn't recognize him. It's as if Rashi is misunderstood. That Rashi can only explain to us why they didn't recognize Yosef immediately. But they're going to be... How many times do we have brothers or brother and sister meeting after 50 years and they recognize one another? The voice, the mannerisms. What do you think? What kind of nonsense is this? They didn't recognize it. So nothing in that shiur some years ago, I describe how Yosef keeps dropping hints to them who he is. He invites them to dinner and he seats them in the order of their birthday. Who could have known this? I think I counted then 18 different hints that he leaves to them. They should know who he is. And they don't recognize him. So I gave a great answer then, and I still stand by that answer. But there's something even simpler here. And we've gone through it. They send the tunic of Yosef dripped in blood, and they tell their father, Hakerno, identify. Yehuda's comeuppance, his punishment is, when Tamar tells him, Hakerno, identify, recognize him. And you know what the punishment for the brothers is going to be? Their punishment is going to be that they stand before Yosef and they can't recognize him. They don't identify him. And when they do find out, they can kick themselves for the rest of their lives. How didn't we recognize him? That's their punishment. Because you didn't identify Yosef as a brother and you sold him to Egypt. Therefore, you can't identify him now. And you're going to suffer at the hands of Yosef. So, it's all part of biblical justice. The idea of identification. right? One more thing and we'll call the shiur to a close. Let's go back to the last page. The Rabbi Pruzensky page. This is one of the ideas that we alluded to now. The top of the page, 114, flight from responsibility. They sent the bloody colored tunic and brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Please identify. Is this the tunic of your son or not?" Ramban and Radak both state that the brothers sent a messenger with Yosef's tunic and commanded the messenger to ask their father that ominous question. Recognize it. Is this your son's or is not your son's? In other words, their plan devised in order to save their family from Yosef's excesses and made the deliberation call for deception. And something else, they did not even have the decency or courage to look their father in the eyes and certainly not to explain to him their meaning. In truth, there was no justification they could offer their father. And among their miscalculations was their assumption that in time Yaakov would come to terms with Yosef's death. That never happened. All of Yaakov's sons and daughters came to console him, and he refused to be comforted, saying, "I will go to my grave mourning for my son." They were so convinced of their righteousness that they took the 20 silver pieces for which Yosef was sold and bought shoes with them. Shoes that they wore every day, even knowing that Yosef, their brother, was enslaved elsewhere. Yosef's brothers never sought to rectify their sin, never even thought it was a sin until long after their reconciliation. I don't really agree with him at this point. It was an earlier point in time that they already realized. We'll talk about that next week. But nothing more typifies their rejection of responsibility for their actions than their unwillingness to confront their father with the information about Yosef's demise. Now, I do want to say, all I can add at this point is maybe a commercial. Rabbi Pruzensky's Sefer was published by Geffen Publishing House here in Yerushalayim. And I got a free copy. Now, the only way I got a free copy, I asked the head of Elon Greenfield, who's the head of Geffen Publishing, I'd like a free copy. He doesn't give anything for free. He wasn't ready. I said, "Wait a minute. Did you look into that safer? Do you know why that safer is in the cell?" "Because I gave him a scholar." I said, "What?" Yeah, so he brought a safer over, and he says, "He stole my scholar." So he gave me a free copy. Now, but he's making it up on me. He's not losing anything on me. He's in the process of publishing my forthcoming book that's supposed to be, they say January 1st, I think it'll be closer to January 15th, and maybe I'll get Rabbi Pruzensky to write an article about it, because the approbations are already in there, and I'm sure he'll do me a good favor and write something nice on his blog, and most probably many people won't want to buy it once they see it, but anyway. It's an excellent, excellent sefer. It's really very good. Beautiful insights into parsha after parsha in Torah. Okay. See you next week.
I wish you could come along, but you should do the work thing, but I said today, you're not going to do the work thing.